If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
You might have heard about the case of the Lower Hutt City Council banning from its premises, like its community hubs, an insert contained in NZME and Stuff-owned newspapers, removing them from some Hutt News editions of these papers. The insert contained an excerpt of Sir Apirana Ngata's book, The Treaty of Waitangi, An Explanation. It was published by the New Zealand Centre for Political Research, run by Muriel Newman, a guest on this show every now and then. And they have asked for an explanation from the chief executive, Joe Miller. So that's what's going down. Jonathan Ayling, the chief executive of the Free Speech Union, joins me to talk about this. Jonathan, welcome into RCR this morning. Thanks for coming on.
Good morning, Paul.
Okay, so you've taken this up, Free Speech Union, and there seems to be a lot of opportunities to highlight issues of free speech at the moment. By writing a letter, an open letter, to Simeon Brown in his capacity as local government minister. So, first of all, your reaction to what you've been told, because you've had communications with Joe Miller, the CEO of the council, about why these inserts have been removed. And I understand in the library, the book is actually there. So, you know, so the book's there, but the insert containing the piece from the book has been removed. What have you been told by them, and why did you decide to go to Simeon Brown?
Well, look, this is an ongoing case, and our work with contacting Simeon Brown, the Minister for Local Government, is just one of the planks involved there. We were approached by the Centre for Political Research. Frank Newman, Muriel's husband, reached out to us and just flagged this story as he thought we might be of interest to it. More than simply taking an interest in it, I'm of the strong opinion that this appears to be a blatant illegal act, that this is in fundamental contradiction to the duties to the Bill of Rights Act that the Hutt City Council has. And so we very promptly reviewed the case and contacted Joe Miller, who is a chief executive on our radar. She, council bureaucrats kind of operate in a similar orbit often, and she's the president of the Society for Local Government Managers, and not an unknown quantity. Former council members of the Hutt City Council have flagged previous decisions she's made with us. So we reached out to her and said, "Look, this appears to be a blatantly illegal act, and just how on earth could you defend this?" And she gave some waffling answer about this having been done in good faith. She didn't really defend the act, but said that it had been done with good intentions. And I think she probably thought that would be the end of the matter.
Is that what they all say?
Well, I don't get up out of bed in the morning and intend to act out of wrong intentions. I don't know anyone who does. That doesn't stop me from making mistakes sometimes. And I think good intentions are a paved way to hell, as the saying goes,
yeah,
far too often. So just because this was done in good faith, the very notion of undermining basic civil liberties in good faith is a somewhat fraught one in my mind, but even accepting that, that's no defense. So we've gone to the Minister of Local Government, inviting his comments, and equally we've gone to the chief executive of NZME, Michael Boggs, who I think probably won't, but should, take a very active interest in one of his newspapers being suppressed and censored by a local government. The Centre for Political Research paid good money to NZME to have this advertisement included, and I think they have probably a strong case to ask for some of that money back, given that they did not receive that advertising in that newspaper because of the actions of the council. And so one way or the other, I think this is lining up to probably a day in court where it'll be interesting to see what the council comes up with. I doubt it will be very much, but if that's the only way we're going to get an honest answer out of them, so be it.
Okay, you might not be able to recall it right off the top of your head. I haven't read the book, so I don't know. What is so offensive about the excerpt? Do we know?
Look, frankly, Paul, I don't know. I haven't read the book. I haven't read the insert. That's beyond interest to me. The point is that Sir Apirana Ngata is a prominent Māori commentator whose view on the treaty if it is of interest, and we would suggest possibly should.
Well, he was
interest.
Alive in the era of that, so it wasn't like he had heard it from someone who'd heard it from someone. It was
that's exactly right, if individuals believe that his work is of relevance to conversations we're having today around race relations, then they should be able to use their hard-earned money to make that case. So, look, I haven't read the insert. I don't blush by saying that at all. Why on earth should I have had to read the insert? All I'm saying is this is a question of an individual wanting to put an insert in the paper. They should be allowed to do that without council bureaucrats sticking their noses in and their sticky fingers deciding what isn't misinformation. The audacity of this case is that the council decided that because the paper had included this insert, it was misinformation because it presented a political perspective without balance. I mean, the hubris that is required for these public bureaucrats to believe that they, I don't know whether they received it from on high or who gave them this authority to decide what is and isn't misinformation and then protect the rest of us good, simple folk from opinions that might hurt us. It is audacious.
Yeah. I think she uses the word in her response to you, misinformation.
That's correct.
And it seems to be, well, first of all, it's a complete misuse of the word misinformation, because how could it be misinformation? I don't know how you come to that conclusion. So she's using the language, the vocabulary of cancel, of shutdown.
Well, look, Paul, your question almost suggests that there is a meaning behind misinformation or disinformation or hate speech or these other terms. I mean, I guess in a technical way there is, but let's not miss what these words are meant to do. They are meant to simply baffle us and tell us that they are opinions or perspectives or speech that we shouldn't be allowed to hear. It's not like there is a good faith interpretation of this language. And I think there's a profound irony in the way that this language has embedded itself so insidiously in common vernacular today. These are words that came out of the Bolshevik Revolution. These were Soviet terms. I don't think it ended very well there. I grew up in Mozambique. I grew up in a country that was part of the Second World, that was a Soviet satellite state. It didn't work there. It didn't work anywhere in the world. I don't know why we would want to import language that simply spoke of the manipulation of facts and perspectives and the suppression of dissent and dialogue in these nations. And this is exactly what we see more and more, this political elite class feeling entirely entitled to utilize these words that they couldn't really define outside of their own reference of being, they are opinions or perspectives or inconvenient truths that we don't want others to hear.
Yeah, well, it's scary. I guess my point is it's scary to hear those non-words rattled off like they mean something.
Absolutely, exactly. That's quite right.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think it might have something to do with the perception they might have of Muriel Newman?
It's entirely possible that that was part of the calculation. I would say it fits within kind of the context around the Treaty Principles Bill that we had here. This was slightly before Waitangi and the Kingi Hui and the Ratana Hui. And so this was all in that context at the time. And I think we're still very much in that space of saying there is only one approved version of what the Treaty of Waitangi is supposed to be. And look, let's give it to NZCPR. It seems to be quite a credible and authoritative spokesperson to be reaching to use the words of Sir Apirana Nata, who obviously sits on our money. Not that many people would know that.
Bill.
Yeah. Well, yes, but how many people use that?
It's been a while since I've seen one.
Look,
I'll think of him each time I'm spending a hundy, you know, I'll think of him.
I think it's an incredibly self-defeating thing. If someone else had decided for whatever reason that Sir Apirana Nata's book should be censored, probably the default setting of our opponents would be to run rampant calling racism and colonialist imperialism. Whereas when another side uses the same author, they're told they're spreading misinformation. It kind of makes me feel that really they just don't want one side to speak.
Next, I'll be hauling into Ed Hillary. Going back to what you said about Joe Miller in that group of CEOs, what is that group again?
It's called the Society of Local Government Managers. So not just the CEOs, but certainly okay. the CEOs of all the local
management class of local body. Is that
that's
is
right? That... And you know what, Paul? So much of our work comes out of the local government space. This is really a cottage industry in many ways of relatively low level bureaucrats who busy themselves with meddling in many ways and often deciding. It expresses itself as deciding what ideas and what perspectives individuals in those local areas should be allowed to encounter.
And given her association with that that group, it's like a club, isn't it? There's a group think in the club.
Undoubtedly. Look, you know, we actually haven't had direct engagement with that particular group, but certainly members of that group and derivatives of it we have.
Okay. All right, so the letter's gone to Simeon Brown, has it? That's been sent.
That's right. So we've been engaging this since the beginning of the week. We were touching base with Joe at the beginning of the week. We contacted the minister yesterday. We contacted the chief executive of NZME today. Tomorrow we'll be contacting the society that Joe Miller is the president of. We'll be asking the president of the society whether she thinks these kind of actions are appropriate for a chief executive within the society. So we'll invite her comment on herself. But really, I think at this point, Paul, we've gotten the full extent of any sort of engagement we're going to have. And that's not enough for me. So I imagine that we'll ask the High Court to review this decision. And I don't think the High Court will take a very friendly view of it. So my advice to Joe Miller would be let's deal with this before we both have to expend more money than we need to in court.
I suppose if she's the chief executive, there's no one on top to say, hey, pull it back. Pull it back. You got it.
I hear what you're saying there, Paul, but I would totally disagree. That's what the role of the council is. That's what our democratic representatives.
Yeah, but they're a bit gutless, aren't they? I mean, I think Lower Hutt City Council has a bit of a history of this kind of.
Look, I would suggest that most of the councils in the Wellington region tend to have a couple of battling individuals there trying to get some good work done, and then probably up against the odds of a number who are gutless, as you say, or simply not doing the role that we would expect of our democratic representatives, for sure. I know that in the wider region there is a real mixture of some individuals who are really stepping out and speaking up. But unfortunately, they are the exception, as far as I can tell, not the rule.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on this. And we were sort of like joking a bit at the start, there seems to be a conveyor belt, a continuing conveyor belt of issues that you can highlight almost on a weekly basis, it seems. So I wonder what's next.
Well, Paul, and that doesn't cover off the things we don't publicise, simply because I don't feel like we have space in our audience's bandwidth to cover off everything we're working on. It really leads me to highlight and underline yet again the fact that I think many of our supporters, you know, the FSU's arguably the largest human rights organization in the country now. We have 100,000 supporters around the country and are building an institution that we want to operate as a permanent watchdog of free speech in New Zealand. And there was real commentary for a while as we got to the end of last year that, well, the government's going to change now. Your job is done. Thanks for minding the shop while Ardern was around, but you can head off now. And I say nonsense. Not only is this government itself also progressing legislation that is highly problematic and arguably quite censorial, but our fight was never primarily with the government. Our fight are with those far more like chief executives and local councils that have embedded themselves in our institutions. And this is true in kind of local government bureaucracy or in the public service more generally. It's true in our universities. It's true in our media. And I actually think the point that you're making is very clear there. We've got more work on than ever before, and people might find that surprising because the government has changed. But I actually think probably the role organizations within civil society have to play now to defend our civil liberties is more important now than it was when perhaps the more censorial were in government, because the opponents of the government now in these institutions are looking and saying the opponents of of those that take a more free speech position are looking and saying, well, hang on, if the government's going to actually advance free speech, if the government's going to stand by these civil rights, we need to do something about it. And so that's why I think we see more examples of public servants actively undermining the government and not in a way that we would say is within their free speech rights. We would be very keen to defend public servants' speech rights, but in a way that is actually an entire betrayal of the system of democratic representation that we've inherited, or in the media as well, or all these other places. I actually think that over the next 3 years, our role will become even more important as these people don't see their kind in Parliament. And so they say, well, we need to do something about it. At that point, we're going to have more of a fight than ever before.
Jonathan Ayling, Chief Executive, Free Speech Union. Thanks for coming on this morning.
Thanks a lot, Paul. Appreciate it.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.